You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
I'll introduce you guys really briefly, and then you guys can dive in. Seth Flaxman, co-founder, executive director of Democracy Works, which is the nonprofit organization behind TurboVote, and Paul Schreiber, who's a software developer who has been described to me as the chief geek of TurboVote and been helping to build out the site. I'm just going to turn it over to you guys. Dive in.
Okay. Great. So Paul, why don't you take it away?
Okay. The screen on? Good afternoon. I'm here to talk to you about voting. Voting is the fundamental building block of our democracy. And while it is a sweltering May day here in Cambridge, I want you to think about last November, the last time you perhaps had to vote, and maybe it was more like this. And this is the kind of weather that makes you want to stay home and not vote. And maybe you actually made it to the polling place and you were confronted with a line like this. Or you finally got inside and you had to navigate one of these voting machines, or worse, one of these voting machines. Or perhaps you got stuck at the office all day and you couldn't quite make it out to the polling place, and that's why you didn't vote. And it's problems like these that lead to a dramatically low turnout in United States elections. In a presidential election, you're going to see somewhere around 50% turnout. In a midterm election, it drops to 40%. And things like primary, special, and local elections, it can be as low as 10%. And there's got to be a better way. And wouldn't it be nice if you could sit at home, sort of by your fireplace, and sip a cup of hot cocoa and vote, and then when you're done, you just drop it in the mailbox. And that would be it. You say, this is great. So, Paul, can I vote by mail? Can I? And the answer to that question is a resounding maybe. The three things you need to be able to do before you can vote by mail. Number one is you need a form. You need an absentee ballot request form. Number two is you need an address. Where am I sending this to? Which election official? Number three, you need to know what the deadline is. When is this particular set of paperwork due? And for you to manage this just for yourself, you're going to have to talk to your state government. You're going to have to talk to your county government. You might have to talk to your town clerk. To manage this for the entire country, where there are over 3,000 different election offices, this is a big, messy problem. You think, well, who likes to solve big, messy problems? Maybe a bunch of venture capitalists out in Menlo Park will find a solution to this. And they will go and they will spend a few $1 million and they will hire a dozen engineers and a couple of lawyers and they will build this. And you think, well, this would be like the kayak.com of voting or something. It'd be great. But then they realize there's not really a good way for them to make money making it easy for people to vote. And they said, you know what, we'll leave it up to the government. And the government will build this. And they will go and they'll spend $50 million and they will hire 50 engineers and 100 lawyers and they will build this and they'll make sure it works out. But, you know, even the government agencies who are in charge of voting assistance haven't done something like this. And so we got frustrated. We said, you know what, we can solve this problem. So we built TurboVote. And TurboVote it's sort of like Netflix for voting. The way it works is like this. You go to our website, and you will fill in a form. And once you've filled in the form, we know where you are, and we know what elections you need to vote in. And so we can send you, absentee ballot request forms automatically. And then we send you text message and email reminders so you don't miss elections. In order to build TurboVote, we got some help from our friends at the Sunlight Foundation. We raised a little bit of money from folks like you on Kickstarter, and we got a grant from Google's public sector group. And last fall, we were able to pilot a service that could be used by 292 million Americans, which is larger than the reach of AT&T's 3G network. Today, we're going to talk to you about three things. Number one, we're going to talk to you about the state of voting by mail in the United States as it is. Number two, we're going to talk to you about some of the technical challenges we faced when building TurboVote. And number three, we're going to talk to you about the future of voting. Now, one of the great things about federalism is that you have all these states and like little laboratories for democracy. But when it comes to voting, it's more like you have the meth lab for democracy. And so we needed to be able to build a service that could answer four questions. One is, can I vote by mail? Number two is, what form do I need to use? Number three is, where does this go, and when is it due? And it turns out that each state, and often each county, has its own set of rules and whether or not you could vote, and how easy it is for you to vote. And so we came up with what we call the sort of turbo vote voter friendliness metric. If something is down and to the left and in red, it means the state wants to make it hard for you to vote. It's up and to the right in green, the state has made it easy for you to vote. So the first thing you need to know is can I vote by mail? And in 30 states plus the District of Columbia, the answer to that is yes. You can vote by mail at any time for any reason or no reason. This is called no excuse absentee. And this is great, and it covers 173 million people. So more than half the population can already vote by mail. And what's even better is that in 7 states and D.C., you can get what's called permanent absentee, which means you fill out the form once and they just keep sending you ballots. And this is great. But the bad news is this only reaches about 1/5 Americans. About 64 million people can do this. The next thing is, okay, well, what if I'm not in one of those 30 states? What if I'm somewhere else? Well, if you're in one of the remaining 20 states, you know, you need to know what excuses are permitted to let me vote by mail. So if you're a college student or you're a commuter, you know, those are sort of the typical situations. But in other states, they have sort of more unusual rules. For example, in Virginia, if you are pregnant, you can vote by mail. Virginia, it's for lovers. Now, if you're in Michigan and you are 60 years or older, you're considered old enough that you can vote by mail. You can't collect Social Security, but you can vote by mail. In Louisiana, if you are on a boat on election day, you may vote by mail. Now, the next thing we needed to know, was once we figured out whether or not you can vote and what reasons you need to declare for voting by mail, is what about the form you need to use? In order to vote by mail, you need to first be registered to vote. Now, in 47 states and the District of Columbia, this is a pretty straightforward process. There's something called the National Voter Registration Form. You can use it, you mail it in, same form for everybody, you register to vote, you're done. North Dakota doesn't have voter registration. You don't need to register, you just vote. If you send the folks in New Hampshire the National Voter Registration Form, they will send you another form, which is their form, which you have to fill out and send back. If you send the folks in Wyoming the national form, they will just ignore it, and you have to get their special form and send in it. Now, this is the vote, registering to vote. But when you want to request an absentee ballot, it starts to get more complicated. There is no national absentee ballot request form. Each state has their own absentee ballot request form, but it gets more complicated because there are 4 states. There are in Illinois, and in Kentucky, and in South Carolina, and Mississippi. You have to get a form from your county. So that means we made 47 forms that covered most of the country. To cover those last 4 states, we'd have to manage an additional 350 forms, just for that small percentage of the population. Now, I want to break this down a little further for you. So of those states, 39 states have a form. 8 states, there is no form. There is no official paperwork. You need to write all of your stuff down on a piece of paper, send it into the county clerk, and sort of pray that you got everything right, and hope they send it back to you. And then you've got the last 4 states, county by county form. Now, what do you need to know to request an absentee ballot? Well, most cases you're going to be asked, what's your name, what's your address, where do you want the ballot sent, some piece of ID like your driver's license or your social security number, and that's pretty straightforward. But in some states, they ask you more information. And when they start asking you more information, like your ward or your district or your precinct, then it becomes harder for you to know that information, harder for you to fill out the form, and you're less likely to complete it and less likely to vote. And there are a couple of states that have particularly onerous requirements to request an absentee ballot. We give the state of Delaware our sort of Raspberry Award because they make you notarize your absentee ballot request form before you can send it in. And the Retro Award goes to North Carolina. Up until a couple of years ago, you had to handwrite a letter requesting an absentee ballot. They have now joined the 20th century. You're allowed to type this letter. But it's still a much higher barrier than most other states. So next is where do you send this in, right? And again, this is what election authority is relevant for you. In most cases, elections are done on sort of a county-by-county basis. The county clerk or the county supervisor of elections manages this process. But in a bunch of states, including here in Massachusetts, it's done on a town level. So that means you have a town, a 75 people, the town clerk has to manage all the absentee ballot requests. And finally, what about the deadline? How much time do I have to get all this stuff together and in on time? Well, in most states, they don't give you a lot of time. You have, you know, to be registered at least 30 days before the election. And there are a few states, the states in orange here, where you have to be registered between 10 and 25 days in advance of the election. And then in North Dakota, again, no registration. And in New Hampshire, you can be registered about a week out. Many cases, this is sort of a straightforward number of days before the election. And in other states, there's a more complicated formula, which you have to figure out in order to know what the deadline is. Now I'm going to talk to you about some of the technology we used to build TurboVote. So in order to build the service, we had to answer a few questions. And the first question we had to answer is where you are, right? And you say, well, this seems like a fairly straightforward question. I'm here in the United States, and here I am in Massachusetts, and I'm in Middlesex County. And in Middlesex County, well, I'm actually in Cambridge, and here's Cambridge, and here's a map of zip codes in Cambridge, and that's where I am, because I know what my zip code is. And this is pretty convenient, because most people like to think of where they are in terms of zip codes. Real estate agents think in terms of zip codes, stuff like that. But zip codes are sort of this fiction. They were created by the United States Postal Service for the purpose of delivering mail. And they don't really respect other boundaries. They cross city boundaries all the time. They cross county boundaries about a third of the time, and there are one or two that might even cross a state boundary, but we don't like to talk about those. And so the Census Bureau and the Postal Service, well, they don't get along at all. So it turns out we actually need to find where you are in two different ways. First thing is we need to find out where the post office thinks you are, so when we mail you this absentee ballot request form, that it gets to your house. The next thing we need to do is figure out what the relevant jurisdictions are. So we'll go to Google and we'll say, hey, where are you? What county are you in? And what city are you in? And so on. And so getting this information from an individual voter, you know, it can be of varying quality. But strangely enough, getting this information from government sources also has problems. And so we needed to make sure that when we sent these forms to the government election officials, it would actually get there. And we went through and we were checking these out. And some of the addresses didn't seem to exist. They either weren't on the map or they didn't have a zip code. And so we would go and phone around. And we called this one town clerk. And we said, you know, I'd like to confirm your address. And she said, OK, this is what it is. I said, oh, you know, that's really funny because the post office, they don't seem to know where you are. She says, no, no, the post office knows exactly where we are. They're right across the street. So the next thing we needed to clarify is sort of what city or town, what municipality are you in? And suppose, for example, you get your mail delivered to your address and you're in West Barnstable, Massachusetts. And you know you're in West Barnstable because when you look out the window, you can see the West Barnstable Fire Department. And you're like, this is great. And you go to the state of Massachusetts and you get a list of town clerks. But there's no town clerk for West Barnstable because you don't actually live in West Barnstable. You live in the thriving metropolis of Barnstable, Massachusetts. So we need to make sure that we have a list of all of the towns that the United States Postal Service thinks exist and map them to all the actual towns that the Secretary of State thinks exist. So next, we need to figure out what county you're in for states that run elections at a county level. And some states, they don't have counties. Louisiana, they have things called parishes, which are really just counties with another name, which is not a super big deal. But when you come to Virginia, you have other problems. So they have counties, but they also have these large cities, which are county equivalent level entities. So something like Fairfax, there's the city of Fairfax, Virginia, and there's also Fairfax County, Virginia, and they have different boards of elections, and they have different forms, and you need to make sure that you know which Fairfax you're in. So we had to go and we had to collect a lot of data to make sure that we could get people the right information in the right forms, right place, and this was often difficult. So we went to government sources, and we went to commercial sources, and we went to Google. And sometimes when we ask Google, you know, what county am I in, depending on where you were, they would spell the name of the county differently. So then we said, okay, we'll go to the National Conference of State Legislatures. And we asked them, which are the states that require excuses to vote absentee, which are the states that don't? And they had trouble getting that list right. We actually had to send them the updated list. So then we said, okay, we'll talk to the Federal Voter Assistance Program. And this is an agency, a government agency that's tasked with making voting easy. And you say, you know what, maybe they have good data for you. And they do. They have the best data of any government agency. But even their information was not perfect. They had typos. They had missing information. For example, there are 3 DeSoto counties in the United States. And according to FAP, they're spelled like this, but they're actually not. They're actually spelled like this. And sometimes we go to a state and we'd be really happy because the state, they would give us, you know, data in machine-readable format, and it would be like Virginia gave us a CSV file, and we're like, this is fantastic. And we started to look a little more closely at their data, and we noticed there was some extra information at the end, which prompted me to ask Seth, you know, hey, have you ever been to Thessalonica? I hear the beaches are really nice this time of year. And then finally, we had to manage all of these forms, and we did forms for the national registration everywhere. We did forms to register in Wyoming. We did all these absentee forms for most of the states, and we did some of them for large parts of Illinois. And we needed to make sure that we had the correct forms given to the correct people, and we needed to make sure that whatever questions were asked, we could present them to you so you could answer the right questions, and we'd fill those all in. And so now we built a service, and we make sure we get you the right form, and we make sure you send it to the right person, and we make sure it gets there on time. So Seth is going to explain to you how this will lead to the future of voting.
Future voting is beautiful, right? About the big picture. So Paul talked about the idea of TurboVote in a very preliminary way, which is we think that if we can make voting more simple, more convenient, that we can increase participation. And that if we can increase participation, our democracy will work better. But there's sort of more specific impacts that we're hoping to make. First is that we think people will vote in more types of elections. So most people, maybe they pay attention to the presidential race every... Oh, this room is so big, I need this microphone.
For the web. Yeah, exactly. So people will vote in the presidential race every 4 years. Maybe they'll remember to vote in the midterm elections. But in local elections, everything other than presidential, you'll often feel like this guy if you turn out to vote, the last man on earth. So we think that once someone might sign up for TurboVote to help them vote in presidential elections, but then our reminders and our mailings will help them vote in judge elections, in school board elections, in mosquito abatement district commissioner elections, which exists in Florida. And not just that, but when you're voting by mail, we think you'll vote in a more informed way. Because when you're voting by mail, you have your ballot right next to you, right next to your laptop. And you can, if you see someone's name, a candidate that you don't recognize, you can Google it. And, you know, for example, most people, when they vote in a ballot box, they'll know, oh, I know who I'm voting for president. I've made up my mind. Or I've made up my mind for Congress or governor. But then there'll be 20 other people on that ballot who they haven't thought of or done the research for. And then there'll be ballot initiatives that they haven't translated yet. So now, if you're voting by mail, you can ask your friends, who are you voting for mosquito district? Anyway, you know what I mean. Or you can ask them to help you translate a ballot initiative into English. And of course, you can also maybe actually use a voter guide because you'll have it with you while you're voting. And in a sense, what we're trying to do is give everyone in the country what Oregon has. So Oregon, 16 years ago, because of a ballot initiative led by Joey. Morning, is he here? Is Joey here? Okay, so he's a Berkman guy. But there's Oregon had a ballot initiative, and they moved all voting to voting by mail. And they saw an increase in participation by 10 percentage points. But in those 10 years, no other state, in those 16 years, no other state has moved all voting to voting by mail. And we've built a sort of a workaround so that everyone in the country, in the states that Paul pointed out, could vote by mail simply in the way Oregon does. And so what's our path, though, to get there? How can we reach enough people, get TurboVote services out there to enough people to actually have the impacts that we're talking about, where people will vote in more elections and vote in a more informed way? And so TurboVote's key idea is to raise expectations for how people should be able to vote so that people think, you know what, I should be able to vote easily and conveniently in the same way I can poke a friend on Facebook or order a book on Amazon. I should be able to vote. And by raising those expectations, we can get people to demand from their local election offices that they want to be able to vote easily. And once we can raise those expectations and turbo vote exists, we can help get the provide that technology to local election boards. And instead of just being a service on top of the platform of government, help improve government services themselves. And last fall, we scaled. Well, so last fall in the midterm elections, we did our pilot program at Boston University. And in that pilot program, 30% of the students who used TurboVote said they probably wouldn't have voted without the service. And we're planning to scale by serving college students, hoping to partner with 100 colleges by 2012. And they would email out to their student bodies about the service, and that's how, and then like cover the cost of forms and mailings. And we think students are a good early adopters for this technology. There's a need there. In 2006, which we think is pretty representative, students voted 29% versus 37% for everyone else. Students like gadgets, they feel comfortable using technology. And there's 20 million of them, and most of them need to vote by mail or register to vote. So there's a need for our type of service, especially, like even more than usual. And there's a lot of different funding sources at colleges to cover the cost of the forms, student councils, administration, alumni. And the forms themselves, every form costs about the same as a medium cup of coffee at Starbucks. So we think it's affordable enough for schools to cover the cost. There's also, the schools are a revolving door of voters, allowing us to sign up a new batch every year. And there are 5,089 four-year colleges in the United States, and we'll be a sustainable nonprofit by just serving 300 of them. And so we hope that in 3 years, TurboVote will serve help a million voters. A million voters will be signed up for TurboVote, and be voting by mail and receiving reminders so that they don't miss elections, and that is the future of voting. Thank you. And yeah.
What did you mean the cost of the forms? Doesn't the student just type in their address and then they get the form from the clerk or whomever? Like, what cost?
Right. So just a brief clarification on the process. So there's the absentee ballot request form you need to send in to your local election office in order to have the local election office send you a ballot. So what we do is we mail you the request form with a pre-addressed, pre-stamped envelope of where that request form needs to go to the local election office.
Filled out.
So so we're trying to make it feel like Netflix. And the cost of sending someone a form with the stamp plus the pre-addressed, pre-stamped envelope to the local election board is the primary cost of the service, because people need to cover the cost of printing and stamps. And BU covered the cost of those forms in our pilot program, and we think schools will cover the cost of forms.
So BU paid you per how many students used
right.
it?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Do you see the future of voting moving to the internet in any way?
So part of the reason we eventually want to partner with local election boards directly is the part of the process we want to move online is the application process to vote by mail. So in Los Angeles County, a few counties in Arizona, they've figured this out. You can apply to vote by mail online, but there's 3,810 local election boards in the United States, and only a very small handful have the technology, the resources, and like the imagination to move this stuff online. But we think that we can help move that process along and make it faster.
But I was asking about actually voting online.
Maybe that technology will be invented, yeah. But
we have no interest in providing voting technology or taking voting online.
Okay, why?
We don't think it's secure and trusted yet.
Say it again.
It's a big, messy security problem. Like trying to develop a secure online voting system would be sort of outside the scope of what we're doing. And
so one of the main complaints people have about online voting is the same complaint they have about widespread vote by mail. Is that in-person voting isn't coercive, whereas vote by mail is.
I think there are also a lot of people who say that most voter intimidation happens at the polls. So there's an alternate point of view on that. Yeah.
I assume that you're going to feedback the information that you developed to the voting, the legal voting mechanisms, federal, state, county, so forth and so on, which will help them step up. I'm particularly interested in voter integrity, vote integrity. There's a number of elections that we've gone through where we see electronic voting. There's the Caltech MIT electronic voting project and all of this kind of stuff. I'm interested in the experience in voter integrity in Oregon, because I've heard some people don't like vote by mail because of lack of vote integrity. And we have a recent rash, more like leprosy, in Republican-controlled legislatures, Florida, Ohio, Michigan, which is limiting suffrage. And so I'm wondering about those instances, because voting is very political. There are people who don't want you to vote for a variety of different reasons.
I don't know what the direct answer is. There are definitely trade-offs. I've seen some audits that said that the Secretary of State of Oregon did some audits on the vote by mail to see if there was fraud, and they came across all right. I'm perfectly accept if you didn't believe those audits. I think that one of the big trade-offs is by voting by mail, there's less voter intimidation at the polls, that people will vote in more elections, and that people will vote more intelligently, and those are things I like. But I see your point. Katie, did you want to address that?
I was going to come to sort of your second point, where you can make the rules more difficult to overcome, but part of the beauty of a system like this is that what I think we're trying to do as a service is to know those rules and to have a single place where all you have to do is tell us who you are and what's going on, and we can help know how to navigate that system. So yeah, as the system becomes more complicated and as the requirements for residency become stricter, we will have a harder time, but hopefully something like this on top of the system means that those won't have quite as much of an impact as they would otherwise. They won't actually add a level of bureaucracy. They'll add some more headaches for us to program in, but that hopefully you could still come and get registered and have everything you need in one place if we're doing our job right. So we do see that as something that makes our work harder, though.
Can I ask a follow-up? Have you talked with the voter integrity community? Have you talked with the Caltech MIT project? Have you talked with the people who have done work for the last 10, 15 years on voter integrity?
We'd love to, but we haven't yet.
You plan to?
Would you like to provide an introduction?
I'm just an interested bystander.
Oh, okay.
I can give names and stuff like that.
I'd like that, actually.
Okay.
Please.
All right. We'll talk.
Sorry. We're very new. We're still making some of these introductions.
Great.
Karen?
So it seems like you've done a lot of great research trying to understand the different rules, regulations, and standards across states and other areas. Do you have plans to put that data up or make it available, and how will that play a role in your service?
Sure. So we were at a meeting in D.C. last week with a bunch of groups who work either in voting or voter registration or just helping people provide information. So it was some folks who were only interested in voter registration, some folks who were interested in increasing turnout, and some folks who were interested in providing information about who your elected officials are. So there are a lot of groups who want this information. They want to know when the deadlines are and where you live and what, all the different districts you are in, from mosquito abatement district commissioner to school board to judge to, state ledge and up. And so the general consensus among the groups at the meeting was nobody really wants to own, it's not a competitive advantage to own this data. Like, we'd be happy to work together. So we're looking forward to working with, all of these other nonprofits and agencies who want to make this information available. And so We collected a list of all the local election officials last fall, and so we ended up getting that to Google, which is how we got our grant from them. So we're happy to share, as much of this raw data as we can, and we want to work with other people to, because there's too much of it. Like, we couldn't possibly gather it all ourselves.
Yeah, please.
So I just want to sort of follow up Stuart's question, and this is not about your work particularly, which is very impressive. It's amazing you've been able to get as good a handle as it is, but it's about the end of the secret ballot. I mean, it does seem to be the way the country is going, but I've never actually heard the argument that there's more coercion at the polling place than there is when
mom and dad are looking over Junior's shoulder. but if there's data to support that, I'd be interested to hear it. But I just wondered, just like, you know, do you have any, and again, it's orthogonal to your, you know, this is the way the system is, this is the way Oregon is, this is the way lots of places are. They're making it easier and easier to have mail-in ballots, and you're trying to facilitate that. And, you know, good for you. If that's what the country wants, we might as well make it easy. But I think it sucks. I mean, I really do. I think the secret ballot is a really good thing that we should not be giving away so lightly.
Yeah, I mean, I think secret ballot is important, too. I think I sort of disagree that voting by mail is getting rid of the secret ballot.
You sort of disagree, or you really disagree? I mean,
I guess, like, when I was saying before the coercion,
you don't think that the sort of, you know, that pressure groups will say, okay, we're all going to vote together, you know, we'll all vote together when we vote, and, you know, we'll just kind of everybody come to Berkman and we'll fill the ballots out here? That's not going to happen.
But what's the difference between...
What
makes coercion at a certain point? I mean, it certainly in a poll, you know, when we talk about voter intimidation, we talk about people confronting someone at a poll.
Have you paid your parking tickets? Yeah. You can't vote until you've paid your parking tickets.
No, right. But I can imagine, say, an employer saying, you will fill this ballot out in front of me the way I wanted to, or you're fired.
And I can,
or a church saying, you will fill this ballot out in front of me and vote with the people you want, or you will be shunned by the community.
Yeah, but I mean, I can also imagine those people reporting that to election authorities and those people going to jail for 5 years. It's a very serious crime. I don't see that changing social norms about people wanting to keep their ballots private.
Is there any data on this? Does anybody know?
No.
There's no data.
There was a study done. There was a study done by Oregon and or Washington about 10 years ago that talked about, and it's, you can Google this, that talked about the incidence of voter intimidation as a consequence of going to all vote by mail, and they found it was negligible. Now, They've got a stake in the game, so you can question it. But
and Oregonians are weird. Anyway. Okay, thank you.
There's no Boston in Oregon.
Yes.
So to get back to what you guys are doing, it seems to me that this is a really, and I haven't looked at the website, you may have this, but it's a perfect opportunity for crowdsourcing, which is you've got all this data down to very minute levels, and instead of you guys having to find it all, if someone who is in a particular location sees something that's wrong, is there a way to communicate that back to you?
I mean, we're
working.
So
on
yes,
that.
We agree that this is a good opportunity for crowdsourcing. There are, of course, you have to be wary about quality control issues and what sort of information you crowdsource.
I'm not suggesting WikiVote. I'm suggesting that there be a feedback mechanism.
Yeah,
so there's two parts to that. One is absolutely when people will tell us if there's something wrong, we'll investigate it and fix it and fix the underlying problem. And two is what we want to crowdsource is sort of a list of sources, right? Like, you know, here is the best place in my jurisdiction to find voting information, and then we can go and find it. So we don't, they'll have better local knowledge than we will, right? But we still want to go to the primary source and get the data so we can be sure it's complete and correct.
Have you guys encountered, are you considering there might be political or legal issues arising out of the model that you described where, I guess you're piloting at universities, and the university fronts a sum of money that I gather the purpose is to obviate everyone having to pay whatever, I don't even know what a stamp costs anymore, it's embarrassing, but pay that negligible amount to have this done for them. You know, I know there are laws that, you know, prohibit paying someone to vote, whether this could be shoehorned into that. And also, that's sort of the legal side of things. And politically, you know, do you expect to confront issues where, all right, well, you want to get students to vote. And universities want to get students to vote. And students all tend to vote a certain way. So we're going to, you know, confront you in some way, possibly with these laws.
So,
you mean vote a certain way that they fill the oval out, or they vote for a given party?
Vote for a given party.
So, the first question, this is why the Cyber Law Clinic has taken us under their wing and helping us, Chris is helping us work through these legal issues, making sure we're in the clear.
Mm-hmm.
For the second part of the question, in terms of scaling, we're being very conscious about serving both traditionally conservative colleges and, you know, traditionally colleges people don't consider conservative because we're not, ultimately our goal is not to serve college students, our goal is to serve everyone. And this is just a good way to get to scale. So, yeah, I mean, we're very conscious of that. We're very conscious of that.
So, as one of the people who have been working on voting integrity for the...
Can you speak up a bit?
So, I'm one of the people who have been working on voting integrity for the past few years. So it seems like you're doing two things. They're separate. One is sort of finding out how to register people to vote, which sounds like a really, really great idea and a really hard thing to do. Another is to find out how to get everyone to vote absentee, which, for all the reasons people have mentioned, sounds like a very bad idea to me. And also for a reason people haven't mentioned yet, which is transparency. Right? When you vote remotely, you send your ballot off and you have no idea what happens to it. And this seems also like a potential problem. So right now you're pretty small, but suppose everyone in the United States actually used your service, then suddenly your own service becomes a huge target for attack. So if I could hack your servers and send for certain zip codes, make sure they get a wrong address when they get the stamped envelope, people will send off their mail, it'll disappear, they'll think they voted, but you can selectively cause people to vote or not vote depending on where they live.
So just to answer the last part of your question, the address of the ballot itself is going to come from the election officials. It's not going to come from us.
Well,
your computer has to somewhere in
our
there.
Computer will help you request it. When you would never think you voted because of us. You would might have thought you requested a ballot, but you wouldn't think you voted.
Good enough then to stop you from voting because there are deadlines for requesting the ballot.
Except that what you're effectively describing are flaws in the system that we're building on top of. They're not actually flaws in what we're trying to do. And actually, I'd like to sort of nominate
There are flaws in the centralization, right? So if everyone has to do their own thing, it's really hard to attack as a sort of en masse. If there's a central choke point that you can attack and it affects 20 million people, suddenly it becomes a very high value target, and people are willing to spend a lot of money to cheat in elections.
My apologies. I was trying to step back to the first half of your question about transparency. It's all right. It's perfectly fine. I wasn't totally clear. I actually have a fantastic county clerk. I'm from a small college town in central Missouri. We run things very smoothly, and I have always had to vote absentee because I'm out here. And I have a county clerk who sends me an email after my ballot request form arrives in the office, and who sends me an email when my ballot gets back and lets me know if it made the deadline or not. And I've missed a couple of elections where my ballot got in the day after, and I got an email saying, sorry, it came in today's mail and it didn't get counted. And I knew that. And it is possible to build systems where, using that outer envelope, you can do vote by mail in a way that's much more transparent than what we're doing. I don't know that we'll be the people to do that, but because the system itself right now isn't perfect, it's not necessarily a reason never to use it.
And also, I want to get back to your point about we're creating a centralized point of failure. And this is like builds on Katie's point, is that right now there are a handful of local election boards that do this well. Very, very few. But there's no private sector company that's willing to make the investment and build the sort of service because there's no money to be made selling the service to local election boards. So one of the things we're trying to do is raise expectations for how simply you should be able to vote and then provide our technology to local election boards so that there are still sort of single, for example, so that Katie's local election official could do what they already do better, but that other officials in Missouri or other places in the country could offer TurboVote-like services in a really simple, seamless way. So hopefully, we would like to go through local election boards and help improve the national infrastructure.
And operate as a distributed system rather than a single point of failure.
Okay.
It's something that was actually brought to mind by one of your comments. You say you're Missouri, but you've been out here, so you have to vote by mail. Now, here, of course, in Massachusetts, although this is not true everywhere, you could consider yourself to be a resident here and vote in Massachusetts. Now, I was wondering, how have you addressed the question of, sorting out which people use your service are in jurisdictions where they're eligible to consider themselves residents of, say, where they're students and which are not?
Not yet.
That actually becomes a very big legal tangle. I'm not sure even if we can sort it out. And actually, the legal experts haven't always sorted it out in ways that agree with each other. Two different sources sometimes say different. I'm not sure we can program it into a single database to provide that advice reliably.
Yeah, the laws can sometimes contradict each other. Like, the one state says, well, if you're in school somewhere else, you have to vote in your other state, and the state you're in school in can say, if you're from another state and just in school here, you can't vote there. And you're like, well, what do you do now? Right. So yeah, this is not a problem we've looked at yet.
But there are some sources that have put a lot of this data together. So one of the next things we'll do is just make it easier to get that information. We're not going to make a recommendation for where you should register, but be like, here's the information provided by this source.
Yeah, what are your options?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Please.
Take me after everybody thought first.
Oh, okay.
So based on the observation that the whole world is divided between those who want to enlarge the franchise and those who want to diminish it, have you had any pushback from those who want to diminish this other than the argument of coercion?
Not yet. We did a small pilot, and so the folks there were happy to have us. They wanted to try the service out. I suspect as we reach more voters and touch more jurisdictions, we may see some of this. One of the problems that I ran into with a different voter registration project was secretaries of state, which is one place you can register with. Like, if you get the national forms and send it to your state, they became overwhelmed with volume and said, start sending this to counties, and they just hung on to the registration forms. And like, no, these are all in a box here. We're not going to distribute them to the counties. We're not going to register these people. And so that becomes a legal issue. So we want to make sure that as we grow, we do this in a way that, the officials at the appropriate level are not surprised or overwhelmed, and we're making their jobs easier, not harder.
Yeah, to address that question directly, TurboVote doesn't require law changes, so that's one of the big differences in terms like TurboVote and Motor Voter or TurboVote and the ballot initiative in Oregon is that you need to have big, like, political mobilizations in order to change law on the books in order to make voting easier. TurboVote just takes existing law that was meant to make voting easier, but because it was done by bureaucracies, actually doesn't, and we streamline all of those rules. So that's like one of the advantages.
And one follow-up question. Where do you stand right now in testing the theory that universities will pay outside of DU?
I'm graduating on Thursday, so I haven't had time to go cross country and market this as much as I can. But if you stay tuned in the upcoming months, I'll be sure that everyone knows like our progress.
Do you see yourself or your project getting into the business of you type your address in and it shows you a sample ballot? That's something I think Massachusetts does very well for these state elections. I don't think they do it for local elections. I don't think every state does it as well as Massachusetts does. It would be nice to have a way to do that everywhere.
Yeah, I mean,
It would be a nice service to provide. And one of the things with all the people we met last week who sort of this sort of voting data co-op. There are other organizations that want to use the deadlines and the election officials to provide sample ballots. And so we don't necessarily need to own that piece, but we might be able to integrate it.
I know I've gone to the League of Women Voters site, and I've gotten some really bad and wrong information from them at times. So
by working together, hopefully we can make sure everyone gets the best set of information, most complete, most up-to-date.
I'm curious how you plan to take it to the parents' generation, because we only have a 50% turnout as well. And it seems like until you make it available to guys my age, as opposed to students, you're never going to dodge the claim that this is not a nonpartisan service.
Well, I mean, so part of the issue is that it is available to everyone. And, like, anyone in this room who's a voter and wants to vote by mail could go on TurboVote and use the service. It's just that, right. Yeah. But the key thing is that serving a school is an easy way to email 10,000 people all at once about the service. So it's, like, a good way to get to scale. If there was a way for us to email 10,000, have an institution email 10,000 adults, like a nonpartisan institution, we would do that.
That's why I wondered if you started looking into that, because you could see a competing group saying going to the NRA and getting their database and doing the same sort of thing, and it's clearly partisan. Yeah. And so I'm wondering if you've thought about how can you reach parents with the same intensity you reach students?
AARP.
Even starting out, actually, we thought about working with not-for-profits, because by virtue of the 501c3 needing to be nonpartisan, they do also have memberships. They have clearly defined groups that you can reach out to. And if, for example, the Rotary Club International decided that they wanted to sign up a city club and all of its members for the service, that's a partnership that we would be happy to take. It's not what we're immediately seeking. But until we're serving county election boards, at which point it is available to literally everyone within that jurisdiction, that would not be about intermediate stuff and could be part of the growth.
I don't know if you heard a suggestion, but it was a good
the AARP. AARP does endorse candidates sometimes, though, correct?
I haven't seen that, but I'm not a member.
They have more than one legal structure.
All right. That would be the one thing we would want to be very careful of. It's the only way from any organization that does actually directly make endorsements.
So I guess we know that people involved in the AARP and the Rotary frequently already vote. What about groups of people that are a little less likely to vote and that also don't necessarily have the same breadth of internet access? So what about people who are accessing the internet only on the I haven't seen your interface.
Sure. So the current version is designed for sort of desktop size, but it would work on a mobile device, for reason like an iPhone or an Android phone, something with a reasonable browser. Certainly, we want to have a sort of mobile focused version and perhaps a native app on some of these platforms eventually, just to make it easy. Yeah, because like what you're getting at is a lot of people who this is their primary means of access to the internet is through their mobile device. And we totally want to serve those people, and serve every, and that also is sort of a universal service because even people who have home or work internet access, they have mobile devices too. So yes, that's great, and it's totally something we want to do. It just wasn't part of the initial prototype.
And also like the digital divide question, right? And so the usual answer I hear to, well, if you move any government services online, that makes it less likely that people who don't have internet access will be able to use them. And the response I generally hear is that you're just creating an additional option for people to be able to access services, and like more options are better. And a lot of times, like someone can watch a town hall on a video who couldn't attend in person because of a job or whatever it is. So it might not be a perfect solution right now, but it widens the opportunities.
And last sort of complementary piece of that is we're a platform rather than an organization, and then everything that we are going to do to be able to reach involves partnerships, and it'll be universities, and it'll be nonprofits, and it'll be county election boards. And for populations like that, we will potentially need, community outreach groups who are taking people with iPhones and actually able to go around and do that outreach. And again, we can help provide the service for it, but that last mile, we're going to need a lot of different partners, and we're still figuring out quite where we want to work and how we can make that outreach. So there might be a group for that, too.
It would be neat if you could reach out to public libraries and have them run, like, registration drives in their labs.
I'd like that.
Okay.
Yeah. Just to put in another perspective in terms of the worry of corruption, I'd say let's run it a ways and see what happens,
right,
as opposed to don't do it because we fear corruption.
Right.
There are always course corrections that can be made.
Yeah.
There's corruption wherever you go now, and there will be more later in different ways, and it will take whatever forms it needs to take.
Yeah, I mean, the metaphor, the sports metaphor for that is you should be more like the NFL and less like Major League Baseball. The NFL changes their rules every couple of years to reflect the reality sort of on the field, whereas baseball will change something like every 50 years. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, go ahead and do it and see what happens and adjust.
The time in our nation of the greatest expression of the franchise was in the populist era at the end of the 19th century. And the progressives took over from the populists at the beginning of the 20th century and instituted the secret ballot. The idea of voting a straight ticket, most people don't know what a ticket was. Voting in the populist era was a social phenomenon. It was clubs of people who got together and figured what they were going to do, and they printed up ballots with all the names on them and took them down to the polling place. That's what your ticket was. So, I mean, we've not always done things the way we do, and there's really good reason to do the way. I'm not saying let's go back to the populist era, because there's all kinds of ways that gets twisted. But the fact is that if there are people who all get around a table and say, how are we going to vote, and figure it out and talk to each other, look stuff up online, and all vote the same way, is this a bad thing? Now, coercion is another thing. But I think that might actually enrich the democracy.
Yeah.
If that's not the only thing that can happen, but sounds good to me.
I have a quick security-related question for you. When somebody uses your service, how long do you save their data?
Well,
Everything except IDs are a different situation where the key thing we want to do is like not save them at all, and we possibly might just like not collect them at all either, depending on how comfortable we are with sort of like taking them and then automatically putting them but not holding them. Does that distinction?
Yeah. So there's some information which we're happy to store, like your name and your address, the way you would store it at sort of any other online service, right? But the more sensitive information, there may be either issue like legal issues preventing storage of it, like birthdays or social security numbers, or just sort of, you know, if you don't store it, then you don't have to worry about losing it, right? So we did the pilot and we have a bunch of that data, but sort of that's different than what are we going to do sort of at scale.
The answer simply is because we want to serve you in multiple elections and keep you as a user long term. We keep everything that you give us. However, we don't ask for anything that we consider substantive. We explicitly leave the social security number line on the form blank and you fill that. That's the one thing you fill in by hand when you turn it around. Because we just don't even want to have it right now until we can really know how we can put it on the form, discard the number, and do that securely. So for the moment, we're using a very, very low-tech way of keeping it as safe as possible. So.
Yeah, please.
Just a response to why not try and see if there's corruption. So first of all, for the forms of coercion that people are afraid of, you just won't see it. Because things like implicit coercion, right, when the parents are looking over Junior's shoulder, nobody's going to report that. That's going to be 100% success. It might change voting patterns, but you will never know. So it's not something that you can test and see if it's bad. And similarly, various types of attacks on the system, because, right, so your county clerk is very nice and tells you when you get the mail, but he can't know that the ballot he received, for instance, is the real ballot that was sent. Right,
there's
that. Because maybe someone intercepted the mail in the middle and changed the ballots. So there were cases, I think, in the UK. They had a sort of trial with vote by mail. And at some point, so this was one of the rare exceptions when they did catch. I think one of the MPs had like warehouses full of ballots. Or there's like a really huge fiasco and they backed off. But in many of the cases, you just won't be able to tell that something bad happened.
Really, I'm thinking off of my feet, but there really isn't some way we can barcode ballots with some sort of a legitimate marker or a scan or a...
So this is one of the type of things I'm working on. So there are sort of more complex methods where you could do things that are more secure, but they're still not... Again, once voting is unsupervised, then there are limits to how secure...
There may be a different way to frame TurboVote in your mind that'll make... I mean,
so
make it more comfortable.
This is just a general argument.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, part of my perspective to it is that a lot of, like, absentee voting exists. Like, people lose ballot boxes full of ballots right now. I mean, and we're hoping that we can improve the current system. So, like, right now, like, a local election board, like, there's no way for us to go to local election boards and try and help them improve their system. But we're hoping we can build the sort of organization that's savvy with technology and that can, like, do the sort of, like, for example, the barcode thing, like, it's not going to happen unless something like TurboVote exists.
Yeah. So
unless there's a service, like a technology service that local election boards can use.
On the one hand, that sounds good. On the other hand, right, you're marking states that don't have absentee ballots as red and bad, and you give them raspberries, where there are very good reasons not to support absentee ballots, and I don't think you should sort of put them on a scale of this is a good state, this is a bad state.
Well, see, I think that you should have the same rights as your friend in Iowa or your friend in Mississippi to vote, right? It shouldn't be harder for him to vote than it is for you to vote. I think fundamentally that's wrong. And so that's why I'm saying
why don't we all vote by text message like American Idol, right? There are good reasons for elections aren't held like American Idol.
That's, I think that's a straw man. Like,
we're
not asking for that.
Right, if one state did that, wouldn't say you want everyone to have the right to vote so conveniently? Because you also want people to have the right to make sure to verify that their vote was counted correctly, to know how the
nobody's doing that. We're not asking to do that. We're asking there's stuff that already is done that is well understood and secure. And
well, it's not secure, right? It's already done, but it's already done badly. So,
yes, please.
And there, on this topic of mailing in versus going in to vote, I think, you know, I mean, my personal view is that the reason so few people vote is because it's hard to get there.
Yeah.
wherever there is. Sometimes you don't know where it is.
Yeah.
Have there been sort of surveys that have been done or studies have been conducted to determine whether people would prefer to mail or prefer to go into a fold?
That exact question, I don't believe so. What there usually are studies where after any given election, they'll do a fairly detailed poll about did you or did you not vote, and then they have self-reported why did you not vote and take the list. And what you find is that about 40% any given year, it was something that just prevented them from going. There's about 60% where it's, I didn't really care who won, I didn't really follow the race, I didn't, there's sort of the apathy and or indifference and or just, what would the correct word be, alienation. For not voting, but there's about a 40% block where it's, I was kept late at work, I didn't know where my polling place was, I had recently moved and wasn't able to get re-registered before the deadline. These kinds of answers, which is the 40% where we think we can make a difference. But whether those people would all use mail or what percentage of those people could be helped by mail isn't immediate.
And the city of Tucson just did something. Were you familiar with that?
They went against
the county of Pima, which is where Tucson is, to institute vote by mail.
Yeah.
For the reason to save money, and that's something we haven't even talked about so far. But jurisdictions are under incredible financial pressure, and their largest single expense is the staffing of polling locations.
Yeah,
it's the largest single expense in Palm Beach County. They hire 8,000 poll workers and pay them and train them for 12 hours ahead of the election. 8,000 in one county. You multiply that, you know, scale that up, and it's an enormous expense that this country's bearing.
And you get the police detail?
All of the above,
All
of the above.
Yeah.
What's your time frame? I think you mentioned that you needed 300 universities or colleges to be sustainable for 501c3. What's your time frame to obtain 300?
2014. Is when we're is the plan to reach the 300, and we're hoping to have 100 for the 2012 election. And there'll be more interest, and you can sign up a bunch.
Are you going to separate between university, state-run universities, and private colleges? Do you have any ratio or?
The main ratio, we're going to try and make sure people don't think we're a political organization. So that I'm mostly concerned about like making sure we have conservative colleges in the mix, but. The real answer is going to have to be stay tuned, because we'll have to see how it goes.
Just out of curiosity, why wouldn't you give this to all the political parties to say go sign up your universities?
I'm the internal voice against doing that.
Okay, well.
And the argument, as I see it, is that what we'd like to do is to actually reach everyone, and the problem is political parties have actually gotten very sophisticated at knowing exactly where their supporters are and are just not interested. So you give them this platform, and they will use it in a very sophisticated way to reach people they already want to reach.
I mean, give them the task of signing up universities.
Then we become seen as allied with one or both of them, and generally most anything that's allied with one party, the other one won't sign up with. You'll see that communications and messaging and polling, every organization that provides those works for only one of the two parties. There are very few trusted organizations that actually provide any service to both of us.
Going back to the earlier figure about 40% saying that you have to take that figure with a huge grain of salt. So that's sort of figure that economists have looked at a lot and know that that's the sort of thing people lie about all the time in polls, right? Because not voting is seen as being a bad citizen. So people will come up with sort of any excuse they can come up with to justify the fact that they didn't.
Turnout rate higher.
We don't expect to have a 40% impact on voters or to have.
Certainly when economists have looked at the effect of whether vote by mail increases or decreases turnout, the results have been very mixed. It's not a clear win either way, because you gain ease, but sometimes making things easier paradoxically makes people less prone to do them, as you lose the sort of social cohesion of going out and voting and getting your I voted sticker.
There's a whole sort of messy situation, which you're right about. But like in terms of making it easier, there have been some studies that say if you make some parts of the process easier, but not the whole process easier, then you don't see an impact on turnout. So like for example, if you're going to make it easier, you have to have like same day registration also. But the key distinction is like you can't just make a single part of the process easier. You have to make the whole process easier. Like you're not going to make a big impact just by making like one single thing better.
I don't think
And, yeah. And you can also say, like, the 60% that say they're apathetic, maybe they're saying they're apathetic because they are too embarrassed to say that they couldn't find the polling place. Yeah. You know, hopefully we just get this thing started and we'll see what sort of impact we can have.
And as far as social cohesion, I do actually think that the I voted sticker is a much bigger argument than most people make it out to be. But I think that, like,
we can mail you stickers also.
Yeah, where Foursquare managed to put in check-in on your polling place locations, I dare say an iTurboVoted Facebook badge would be a very, very easy thing to set up. And that with a little creativity, you can still build social cohesion using web tools. So.
Yeah.
Just a question. Do you have support for people who want to vote in person but want to use your system to register and find out where their polling place is?
We won't tell you. Right now, we don't find your polling place. We will certainly help you register. And you could just, you know, either not request the absentee ballot or just not send it in. So you could just do the registration now. Yeah.
And we would provide you reminders as to when the local elections are coming up. And that's a free part of the service. And if you chose not to request a ballot, that doesn't actually bother us. So
thank you.
Thank you very much.